fries. Wake up. Shake up your business.
Hello, welcome to the Enterprise Breakfast Podcast. Each week we bring you a little breakfast buffet where we just sprinkle dollops of yumminess from the past week's show to help you disrupt your day and your thinking. And on this episode, it's a rip-off. And no, we're not talking the real fake copy kind either.
Oh my God, there is nothing worse than being ripped off. You know, when someone makes you pay too much or do too much or give too much or feel too much or repay too much or charges you too much with the full intention of making sure they get more out of your effort than you could ever hope to receive, and you don't even know about it when it's happening. You only find out later, and then, OMG, there's nothing worse than being ripped off. And you know the worst offenders to rip you off? People who need people to be the other part of their business. Like when you make money from somebody else's efforts because you've had a good idea, and if you've got the foresight and the initiative and the business acumen and you hire someone with the skill to do the idea and then you pay them for the job but then you just keep on making money for it well after they've left the building, I mean, let's face it, Mr. Business couldn't do it without Ms. Skilled, and possibly Ms. Skilled might just paint away in the attic without Mr. Business. Of course, one needs to take into account overheads, how much it costs to run a business, to hustle for business, and of course, the cultivation of relationships is also really worth something. The business acumen is worth something as much as the art around which the deal is centred. And one needs to take into account the materials one needs to create, whatever one creates, but be that as it may, was one worth more than the other? And what about credit cards? The charges on credit cards. You don't even know that they're happening.
Oh, I hate the banks. God, they rip me off.
I think ripping someone off is actually worse than stealing, because ripping them off is done to your face with a smile, pretending that you're helping, and entails a secret breach of trust. And a breach of trust is a betrayal. And if you're a betrayer, may the wrath of the universe fall upon you. May your house be beset by locusts. May your children always come home with lice from preschool. Your genital organs fall off. And may your toilet not flush for a week forever after. I'm just saying, right?
So can Mark Zuckerberg and Meta really rip off Australian newsrooms, or will they be posting cat videos instead? Co-founder of TV Black Box, Rob McKnight, says many media outlets will be worried about their bottom lines.
Well, we're talking big profit drops, and they'll be losing their genital organs as well. I think I just lost mine after your rant there. You scared me so much, Libby.
But it's not only members of our fourth estate getting hot under the collar. Singer, songwriter, barrister, and all-round advocate for artists, Mark Holden, he's not holding back his feelings when it comes to standing up for his musician mates, especially when our music industry practices are the same as those in Russia?
Let's just start with what the right is for a start. The right is all copyright is created by statute. It doesn't naturally exist. Property like a castle, you have a moat around it, it's a physical thing. But songs, music, records are intellectual property, and they're only created because a society decides they will through legislation. And the world has decided about copyright through the WIPO Treaty, and it's existed for nearly 60 years. And in that treaty, the people who actually create the music, the musicians, the guitar players, the drummers, the singers, the background singers, the harmony singers, a right was created for them to receive a stream of income from the performance of their records on radio and television and in gyms and you know, in various other places, coffee shops, etc. However, in order to get that through the radio stations, because the money is the 1% is of of the income from commercials on radio stations. In order to get that through in the 60s, when businesses were, you know, in control of everything and the individual worker was not in control, and certainly musicians were not in control and singers were not in control, they had to agree to a 1% cap to get the radio stations to even take it on as a concept. Of course, there's no other business in the world that I can think of where the actual workers are excluded from negotiating on their own rights. So musicians and singers have been excluded from negotiating this 1% cap since it was created 60 years ago. So that's the mechanism by which the money is generated for this pool of money that's then supposed to be paid to singers and the people who actually create, the workers who actually create the music.
So my question to you is, we've got two different scenarios going on here. We've got the radio stations playing the record companies a lump of money for
playing the records, yeah.
For playing
no,
the records.
Not paying the record. No, they're not paying the record companies. They're paying a not-for-profit organisation that distributes the money.
Okay, like APRA.
Which is called PPCA.
Oh, PPCA, okay, fine. And then you're saying within that, the guy that played the drums on How to Make Gravy doesn't get another cent.
Pete Luscombe.
He doesn't get another cent except for, say, the $50 that he got 20 years ago.
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct. Whereas in every other country, all of Europe, England, Belgium, Sweden, North America, most other countries around the world signed on to this WIPO treaty to make it available to all musicians, all singers who make the record. But in Australia, the record companies who were international companies, think about the 60s. It was big companies like EMI, who was an English company, BMG, which was a German company. They were all big multinational companies. And they had the power. And they set up this thing, PPCA, with eight board members. Five of the board members are record companies. One of the board members is a manager, and only two of the board members are actual musicians and singers, even though the right is created for musicians and singers.
So, Mark, I'm just trying to think of an equivalent industry. Are you saying that the session player who was engaged to play on a song that perhaps...
How to Make Gravy, Pete Luscombe.
Okay, let's use him. And yet... It was Paul Kelly that wrote the song, Paul Kelly that had the deal with the record company and the record company that created the environment for that did the deals to get the album out there. Are you saying that the worker that was just in, I've used the word just, isn't that interesting, was engaged to play the drums on that should be entitled to further payments? That's like saying
in
that
every other country in the world, the only countries in the world now that honour that, you know, obviously
but don't. Who are we in line with?
Is Australia, New Zealand. It was India and Russia, but India recently just signed Article 15.1 of the WIPO
Treaty. So it's us and Russia and New Zealand.
Yes. I know, but look. Let me give you.
No. We've only got a couple of minutes. Are you?
Let me give you a concrete example.
Okay.
I was a member of AFTRA, a union in America, for 16 years. When I made a demo that was used in the song Splash, even though I was not signed to a record company, I was the singer and I was a member of a union, and I have been paid by Disney since 1982, about $100 American twice a year. For 40-something years. The guy the Bob Vanier, who played the flugelhorn on the end of Reminiscing. Reminiscing is one of the highest performed songs in the world. Mm-hmm. He has never received a residual because he's not a member of Little River Band. The international, multinational kind of, let's call them, post-colonial patriarchal world created an environment where only the people who were signed to record companies would get that royalty. But we are one of three countries in the world who does that, and it's so that the multinational record companies can get their slice. And yet, it's created for the actual creators of the music, which is Pete Luscombe, the drummer. Bob Vianney, who played the flugelhorn on Reminiscing. And in countries like England, the Bob Vianneys and the Peter Luscombs are making $50,000, $60,000 a year for 40 years that Australian musicians have not received. It's an absolute obscenity. Our unions have totally failed. We have a couple of members of our Article 15 advocacy group who are union members and who are trying to get the MEAA on board with this. But in 50 or 60 years, our unions have failed. They have never made this work for Australian musicians. Australian musicians are 50 years behind the rest of the world, and it's just an absolute obscenity.
And if things aren't bad enough at the supermarket with rising food prices, pretty soon you'll find out that your favourite vegetable is no longer available. That's because Aussie vegetable growers say the big supermarkets are still not playing fair when it comes to pricing.
Look, it starts with the extraordinary power imbalance that exists between the relationship and the contractual negotiations between small family-run horticultural businesses and multi-billion dollar retail outlets. And that power imbalance then seeps down like an invisible hand that sort of throttles the throats and the livelihoods of small growers.
There doesn't seem to be much opportunity to sit at the negotiating table as an equal partner. I can imagine growers would just feel this sense of not wanting to jeopardise what they've got in order to get a fairer deal.
That's right. Look, I can't overstate the fear and anxiety that growers feel when they approach negotiations with supermarkets. Now, whether that fear and anxiety is justified or not really doesn't matter. The fact is that these growers genuinely feel that if they contradict or challenge or refuse anything the supermarkets ask for, then their contract and their livelihood in selling to those supermarkets will be in jeopardy. And I think it's really important, Libby, to understand that horticultural growers, fruit, nut, vegetable growers, are in a much more precarious position than the other suppliers to supermarkets. Their product is highly perishable. If they don't sell it within sometimes the space of a few days or a few weeks, then it can't be sold. And so it's all very well for people to say, oh, well, if they don't want to sell to supermarkets under supermarket conditions, they can sell to someone else. By the time they know that the supermarket isn't going to take their product, they've probably not got a saleable product.
Oh, so there's argy-bargy.
Exactly. And the other thing that puts them in a very vulnerable position is that they can't brand their product. One tomato is pretty much like another tomato. One peach is pretty much like another peach. Unlike Arnott's or these big companies with brands that have value, if a grower doesn't accept the supermarket's terms, then there are plenty of other growers that they can buy from, or increasingly, there's overseas product that they can import in and sell.
So in actual fact, the care that Red Dot Tomato puts into it, you can't actually create a brand with what you're producing, which gives it that extra value on the market.
That's exactly right. So those two things just put growers in an incredibly vulnerable position. And I think the other thing to understand is there seems to be a pattern. Intermittently, the supermarkets will come out and say to horticultural growers, we think we're going to need this many carrots or this many apples or whatever it is over the coming weeks. And so these growers gear up to make sure they can meet that demand that's coming. And then lo and behold, comes to the pinch, oh, look, we don't actually need quite that many. So these growers have grown this product on the assumption that the supermarkets will honour the estimates they have provided, and then they don't want it. What does the grower do? Tries to sell it on a local wholesale market or something at a rush, has to discount, and then the supermarkets can come back with all the face of Myers and sort of say, well, actually, we've noticed it's selling for this on the wholesale market, so we think we should be paying you less.
Oh.
And so it goes.
That is a rip-off. Can you tell me, paint me a picture of how the worst possible scenario negotiation that people obviously experience every day, can you paint me a picture of how it would unfold, say, with a humble zucchini?
Well, first thing is that very often there may only be three or four zucchini suppliers to a particular a supermarket. So the thing to understand there is that if they do complain, if they do push back, if they even if they do it anonymously, like many of these inquiries are now allowing them to do, it's not too difficult for the supermarket to find out which one of the three suppliers is causing the trouble, and lo and behold, that found another supplier next time round.
So, but what happened? So my understanding is that the consumption of fruit and vegetables is falling, which of course then puts pressure on the growers in terms of what they can supply, what the market will sustain. What's the markup like in the supermarket from what they pay for the supplier to what they sell to me and you?
Well, this is one of the issues, Libby. It's very, very difficult to know with any accuracy what that markup is, because the whole negotiation and contract process is done with no transparency whatsoever. So it's very difficult to know. And what happens, of course, is the supermarkets know the prices that everyone are offering to sell for, and so they've got all that power, and the grower only knows the price that they're offering to sell for. So very often it starts right there with the supermarket saying, oh, well, look, we've tested the market and we actually think we can get it for 20% less than you're offering it to us. So unless you can match that market price, we'll look elsewhere, thanks very much. So already there's that pressure on them. And then, as I say, that's added to by the pressure, well, if I don't sell my zucchinis in the next week, they're not going to be saleable. So I'll probably have to accept whatever price the supermarket is offering me. And then there's all these things in the contract that says things like, oh, well, it's a fixed price contract or it's a fixed volume contract. But what happens is there's a little subclause in these contracts that says, except by mutual agreement. So the supermarket can say, we'll take 10 tonnes of your zucchinis over the next week.
Jolyon Burnett, National Farmers Federation Horticultural Council Chair, telling us how it is out on the land at the moment. That's it for now. But if you liked what you heard, can't wait until next week for more. You can tune into the live shows on DAB Plus if you're in Brisbane, Sydney or Melbourne, or online at disrupt.radio. Talk soon.
Disrupt Radio. Tune in to opportunity.